When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to a delayed edition of the Psychovertical podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. I apologise for the delay. I've been travelling and all that kind of stuff. I've been trying to keep to my schedule because my daughter, if I miss uploading this podcast, my daughter gets on my case and tells me I have to. So maybe this might replace one. This might replace one on Tuesday. Because what day is it? Sunday today? Yeah, but is it Sunday? Anyway, this is some day of the week. So, but I know what it's like when you go to download a podcast and it's not there, and it's always highly, highly distressing. And you have to, but sometimes it's good because you have to go and find some other podcast, which might be a lot better, like Grimer's podcast or something. Thanks for all the feedback I've been getting. Hopefully, the sound is slowly getting better. I'm still unable to really do any Skype-y, like interviewing, having conversations with people because wherever the Wi-Fi is good enough to do it, the sound is terrible. There's too much noise, and where there's not a lot of sound, there's the crap Wi-Fi. So I'm currently recording this where I live, and it's kind of quiet. I have this weird thing every day where. Like you have the call to prayer about, and I keep going about the call to prayer. We have the call to prayer, like, so it's annoying, but when you get the call to prayer at like 4:30 in the morning, 5:00 in the morning, it's a little bit irritating. But when the call to prayer starts, like and it starts and it goes on for a little bit and then it stops. So if you're devout, you have to get up, you have to pray, then you have to go, then you probably go back to bed or something. Or get in your car and drive around the streets making lots of noise and doing, like, you know, sort of skids and stuff, like some people seem to do. But anyway, but every day when you have the call to prayer, someone starts making themselves be sick in where we live, whether in this block of flats or another block of flats. It's kind of really weird. It's like a little thing, you know, like the call to prayer suddenly sort of dies away and the person has obviously stopped praying. And then they start like making themselves be sick. So it's a little sort of window into the strange nature of humanity. So so what was my point? Oh yeah. So thanks for the feedback. I've decided on reflection not to stop waffling and rambling because it sounds like that's probably the only thing that's interesting. Interesting about this podcast is that not the stuff I'm supposed to be talking about, but all the other stuff. Speaking of which, because I didn't get the podcast out on time, I had loads of good reasons. Mainly, I just couldn't be asked to do it. I think I was having a bit of a day where I just couldn't be asked. Really, couldn't be asked with the world, and I apologize. One thing it's really important to learn. When you're on the stage, darling, when you're a stage actor like I am, is So, if you're a performer, a monologist, as I am, as one of my livings, and you stand on a stage, you kind of need an audience. Otherwise, you're just a crazy person, or you're really rich, and you can just afford to like hire a venue and just stand there and talk to yourself. So, you have this thing where when you first start, like, luckily now having done tours for a long time, generally I would say either they sell out, and they're not like giant venues, but generally they either sell out or they're about like 80% full, which is good. And that's why it's often better to do a really small venue, like even like a pub where you can get 100 people in it, rather than a venue where you can get like 800 people in it. Because even if you have, you know, like eight, if you'll manage to find like 100 people to fill a pub in like Aberdeen or somewhere. But if you can only manage to get like 500 people in like a 800 seat venue, then you feel a bit crap, where you don't feel as, you feel like, oh God, why is no one coming to see me talk? So yeah, a little venue, like a really good venue. Yeah, like that's why comedy clubs, loads of people often say to me like, oh, why don't you go on the comedy? I am actually funny sometimes, but people are like, why don't you go on the comedy circuit? And I said, have you ever been to like a comedy club? There's like 30 people in there, you know, like what's the point really? So, but the lesson of this story is there is a tendency sometimes if you go somewhere and you're talking and not many people turn up, like I've had, like on the, I think the first podcast I did, it was about my life as a performing artist or something, you'll turn up and there's like a really disappointing number of people. Like I know, like I remember David Brashears, what his name is, who climbed Everest and stuff and made films. He came to Sheffield once and only three people came to see him, which is like crazy. It was like God turning up and no one, and I've read the book, you know, like people didn't come and see him. So it's never been that bad, but sometimes you realize, like more in the past, less now, but you were like totally crushed and because there wasn't many people came to see you. And you have this, the reason you're on stage is that you want to be loved and adored and you want someone to fill in all the gaps that, you know, where you should be able to give yourself a hug and all that kind of stuff. You know, you want to, and it's almost like the worst ever thing anyone could ever do, basically. I don't know, I highly recommend, if you've not seen it, one of the best films, comedy films ever made, which is a film that hardly anyone's ever seen, is Hamlet 2 with Steve Coogan. But there's a really good line in there about, like, you know, like I felt rejected by my father, so I became an actor, and then I could be rejected by the audience. But a sign of a true professional, maybe you can apply this to other things in your life, is that when hardly anyone turns up, don't punish the people who did. You know what I mean? Like, don't be like, oh God, I'm going to give you like a heart, you bastards. I'm going to give you, just going to run through it and get off the stage as soon as possible. No, like when hardly anyone turns up, that's when you have to give it like the absolute maximum performance and give people, like people, make them feel like when they go away, they're like, oh my God, like anyone didn't come and see that, they're a fucking idiot. Like that was amazing. Rather than like, oh Christ, I can see why no one came. So yeah, lesson over. So, but on the subject of reliability. So when you don't post a podcast, like I was annoyed to not post. Well, I wasn't annoyed at all, but I'll tell you I was, because then it makes me feel like I was annoyed. But on the subject of not posting a podcast, when you're all, you know, like, you're all, I think the most, I think one podcast has had like 5,000 people listen to it. That doesn't mean they got to the end. They're probably like, what the hell's this shite? But those like five people out there who are just dying, or maybe one, who are dying to listen to, probably my daughter, were dying to listen to this podcast. You know, what's he going to say this time? And you were disappointed. The importance of reliability, I reckon. And I think people don't really talk about reliability that much, but I think it is like a real fundamentally important thing, is that people need to know what you are or what something does. Like they don't mind if you're shit. Like, oh, that guy's shit. And then you are shit. It's like, well, he at least is reliable, you know. But I often make this analogy with a hammer. You know, like if you got a hammer, you bought a hammer, and the first nail you're trying to bang in, the hammer breaks, you're like, oh, that's a bit of shit, you know. So if you're going to be a hammer, you know, be a hammer. And for a while ago, I sort of worked with Patagonia a little bit. And when you work for Patagonia, maybe I've told this story already, but when you work for Patagonia, you get this big dossier of like how to, you know, like basically to program you into be a Patagonia type person. Must eat organic food and all that kind of stuff. Must go surfing and all. Must learn to swim. And must preach to people not to fly while flying. But in this big dossier of like the world according to Patagonia, there was this big thing about McDonald's. This is probably top secret. It's probably going to destroy the. They haven't got stocks and shares, but anyway, Yvon Chouinard's going to be like, no. Anyway, so yes, yeah, so Yvon Chouinard is secretly a massive big McDonald's fan, and. Mainly it's because like, McDonald's have this amazing supply chain, which is like built up over like, you know, 50 years or something. So because the most important thing for McDonald's is reliability. And that is why if you're in like, you know, like you're in Saudi Arabia or you're in, you know, like Argentina or you're in Alaska, if you go and buy some chips from McDonald's, they will taste exactly the same. There's no like special like curry sauce on them or whatever. Like they're exactly what they're supposed to be. And that is why McDonald's is like so successful is like, I would actually argue, I don't actually think McDonald's is bad for you. I think actually the people who eat it, you know, they're the bad element, not the actual food. You shouldn't punish people for producing what people want, which is, you know, it's the people who are garbage, not the food. Anyway, I quite like McDonald's. Anyway, so I am a garbage person, but it's in my DNA. I can't help it. So I always think about that. And McDonald's. But every time you see that Patagonia, you'd be thinking McDonald's now. Is Patagonia had this thing where they, I think someone found a. Like a supplier of buttons, they had these like buttons made out of like, you know, testicles of walnuts or something, or some kind of like organic kind of thing. And they found like a cheaper, you know, cheaper one, like, you know, like the teeth of a raccoon or something. They found these like cheaper buttons, you know, so they were saving maybe like 5 pence or 5 cents, five dimes on buttons. So they were great. This is great. We're gonna make a lot more money with this. So anyway, what happened was all the buttons started breaking. So, you know, you'd be there in Hawaii, you know, like, you know, hanging 10, and your button would break and you'd be like, fucking hell, this is, oh God, this is terrible. I'm going to buy a North Face one next time. So the cost of the buttons breaking could be millions and millions of, you know, if you think of all the money that was invested by Patagonia and the goodwill and people telling people to buy this and all that kind of stuff. And suddenly like your buttons, this little button that costs like one pence, you know, or a fraction of a pence breaks is incalculable really. So reliability is very, very important. So, you know, very important in life and everything else. Before we get on to the crack on with the thing, one reason I didn't do the podcast was I was kind of like I made this mistake probably a year ago. Like I went through a phase where, well, people would say I was being very political, but I don't see it as being political. I'm not actually interested in politics. I'm kind of interested in why people think the way they do. I'm not interested in what they think. I'm just interested in why they kind of think it. So I went through like a period where I wasn't really that interested. I was actually climbing all the time. I literally every day I was going climbing. I was like traveling around the world, going climbing. But the more climbing, it's a bit like, you know, if you're not having sex, like sex is the only thing you can think about. But when you can have as much sex as you want, you're not really that arsed really. It's a bit like that really. So I wasn't really that bothered about climbing because I was actually climbing all the time. So I was more interested in other things, like kind of weird stuff about why people think the way they did. So I went through like a phase of like posting just weird things that came into my head, or weird things I read, or you know, often they were like little tiny, like a little fragment of something, and I just like post an image and whatever. And I would say and this probably went on for a while. Anyway, loads of people thought I'd gone crazy, and I remember like Niall Grimes said he said he would interview me on my podcast, but I couldn't talk of any like Unibomber kind of stuff. I didn't even know the Unibomber was. I kind of had an idea, but I read the Unibomber's manifesto, and it probably was actually exactly what I was like, you know, talking about. So I did this, and it really kind of wrecked my life in a way, because of reliability. Like, people just want me to be this climbing person, and a very specific kind of climbing person. And if they you know, come to my my Instagram or Twitter, and I'm not talking about that, I'm talking about something else, then people are kind of outraged, and they're like, stick to what you know, and all that kind of stuff. And people email you, and you know, so it's there. And because of my DNA, I'm not a kind of person who will submit very easily, which I wish I did, really. Because I have this story I tell them like a million times. It's probably not even true, but it's one of these, it's probably like a lie that's become truth. And it's because it's a lie, it's probably not actually serving me very well. But I remember this story where someone wanted my mum to do something kind of illegal. And, you know, my mum was like super poor. And she always like jokes. If I ever said we were poor when we were kids, she's like, you weren't poor. I was poor. You know, so it's, you know, she wants to own it basically. So someone wanted to do this something illegal. And she said, oh no, I can't, it's against my principles. And this woman was like, Sue, you're too poor to have principles. And she was like, no one's too poor to have principles. And so that kind of is like probably a foundational thing in me, is that I don't like, you know, people say I don't like bullies. People often say that are actually bullies themselves, but I think I wrote a story. I got a story somewhere. It's a really, really grim story. It might be in my book. It might be in Unknown Pleasures. But it was when I was a kid, and all these kids got me and like held me down, and they all just started spitting on me, and I just literally just like spitting all over me, and I just couldn't. I was much little smaller than they were, and I couldn't get away. And but it was this feeling of like sort of taking it, just take it. Does that make any sense? So the more I feel I have to just give in, it makes me kind of double down, really, which is probably. But I think, and also there was probably an element of at the time of me not wanting to be a very liked person. It was kind of like self-destruction is a very it's like a process. It's very very healthy, I think, in a way, to destroy yourself, because then you have to sort of make something else. So if you don't really feel like you're, anyway, I probably have to write a book. I have to write it all down, because it's actually quite complicated. But I ended eventually stopping, because Vanessa, my wife, she just found it too upsetting, because how people would see me wasn't now how I was. You know, people thought I was a racist, or, you know, misogynist, and all that kind of stuff that was very, you know, 2010s. And that's kind of not really who I am. And she was always like, why don't you just, like, when you talk about things, people can understand what you're saying, but when you write it, you just sound like a crazy person. And probably the you know, because on Instagram and Twitter, you don't actually have much of a room to actually make a very, you know, strong case. And then you get to the point where you just don't really care what anybody, like, if someone's not going to meet you, it's not halfway, it's probably like, you know, 99% of the way there. Then it's not even worth the effort, really, because so many people are, you know, they just can't, they'll never understand what you're trying to say. You know, they'll just immediately think you're saying something bad because they don't understand what you're saying. So, But anyway, so I stopped doing all, I decided not to do that really. Maybe sometimes, every now and again, I might go crazy and say, you know, say something on Twitter or something. But I kind of stayed away from it, just for your own kind of mental health, really. But then last week, I saw that someone posted a picture of me. It wasn't me. It was like some naked guy. And it was something about Alex Honnold, like staying out of politics. And maybe it was like a reference to me staying out of politics. And as I say, I'm not a political person. And so I made like a small defense of Alex Honnold on my Instagram and stuff. And I basically was like that you shouldn't punish somebody. Like, you shouldn't punish someone. You know, the classic thing is Alex Honnold says something which could be mildly viewed as having a political position about, you know, Martin Luther King or something, and about, you know, reparations or, you know, like, so, yeah, this kind of stuff that's, like, highly charged. Like, he could have said it, you know, 15 years ago, no one would have cared. Everyone would have been like, I totally agree with you, Alex. But now it's, like, so, these things are so charged that, you know, he seemed to be getting a lot of flack from people. You know, he wasn't saying anything. He's not going to say anything like really crazy. But and I think I just said, like, just why can't we just, like, you know, so Joe Rogan is, you know, one side of the world now thinks Joe Rogan's this like sexist, homophobic asshole, you know, and Bernie Sanders is like associating himself with him, and the other half knows the truth is none of those things. But, you know, one side are like, I'm never going to listen to Joe Rogan ever again. And it's like, have you ever listened to Joe Rogan? Because if you did, then you wouldn't be saying that, because you would have known, you know. So you know, with Alex, he's like, I'm never going to buy a North Face jacket ever again. It's like, what, you're not going to buy stuff from like some hellish sweatshop in Vietnam? Anyway, so I just kind of tried to defend Alex a little bit. Like I said, I don't necessarily, and I always made that mistake. I should never say that. I should never, because people always say about me, like, oh, I don't always agree with what Andy says, but, and it's a way of like distancing yourself from somebody. And so you don't get any like blowback. I remember that time when you said that guy from the, you know, the Nazi party was actually, you know, he was quite good at making, you know, like fondues, you know, it's like, well, I liked his fondues, but anyway, so anyway, so I posted this thing, and then I just got this like barrage of crazy, like Manson family women, just kind of like, how dare you, you know, how dare you? And it's like, hang on a minute. Like, I thought I was actually defending the position you take, and then I got into the whole like white privilege, how dare a white person, you know, even use the word Malcolm X and all this kind of stuff. So I ended up getting a hate speech strike on my Instagram, which was because I think I said that, generally, like in South Africa, in the apartheid times, they had this like comb test where they would put a comb in your hair, and if it stayed there, you were black, and if it fell out, then you were white. And so I said, I said something like, I'm going to have like a comb test. Like, if I put a comb in my hair, it falls out, therefore I'm guilty of privilege. And if it doesn't, then you can just be a racist, a bigot, and get away with it, you know. So really what I should have done is just not said anything and just been and not even commented. In fact, I should have just deleted the Instagram post. And that was my point. So all these assholes who were getting on me actually proved the exact point I was making, which is the problem with all this kind of stuff, is the people are just morons, basically. I should actually say a nicer word. But so what I was saying about Alex's thing is it's a kind of form of violent, like political violence, is when you see someone who is just expressing a political opinion that's not extreme in any way, and everyone basically just attacks them to the point where they're like, okay, I will never say anything ever again. I will be, you know, I will be a good, I will stay in my lane. I will be a, you know, I will just be this climbing Alex Honnold, but I can't be anything else. For me, that's kind of unacceptable. Like, I'd rather have, like, before I went crazy, I had people, you know, I was like neck and, you know, I have this thing with your neck and neck on Instagram or, you know, with followers on Twitter. Like, cause I've been on Twitter for like a long time, and, you know, you're neck and neck with this person. And then when I look now, you know, they've got 48,000 followers and I've got like, you know, 15,000 followers or something. Like mine just never, ever went anywhere because of the you're punished really for not just being who you're supposed to be this, you know, to be, it's in a way, it's a kind of like a, it's like a caste system or a class system where you, like I'm not qualified to have any opinions apart from crampons, where really often the people who are saying that are really unqualified to say anything at all because they're just by saying that they disqualify themselves from having any opinions at all. If you know what I mean. So I think after that I was just a bit over it. Like, oh Christ Almighty, but. But that's not the way to, that you have to, you can't be like that. You have to, you know, in a way you have to stand up. So what I'm going to eventually do, like I've been talking about, like sometimes when I've been doing these podcasts, I've been talking about things that are straying out of the way of what I'm supposed to be talking about, which is climbing related stuff. So I've decided instead of like melding any of those kind of things into this, I'm just going to have a completely separate podcast, which is not about politics, but it's more about so different ways of looking at the world in a way of, because probably the bit I've actually missed out here is as soon as I stopped kind of saying this kind of stuff, you know, like is that people then started coming saying like, oh, actually, well, a lot of people were like, oh, I kind of missed that kind of stuff because it was like more interesting than the climbing kind of stuff. And then other people started saying, actually, I used to think you were a complete knobhead and I just thought you were a crazy person or a racist or whatever. And but now I'm actually I don't think that at all. And actually now I'm really confused and I don't really know what to think. I don't really know. Yeah, I've got no real compass in the, you know, to understand what's going on in the world and stuff. So it's typical. As soon as you stop doing it, you know, now you have like Ricky Gervais on the, you know, on the Golden Globes or whatever. And, you know, even my son was like, oh, I think he was like, oh, dad, just keep doing, just, you know, don't think you should stop, you know, being yourself, which is probably down to Ricky Gervais because if someone's high profile does it, you can, you know, but then I don't like being trendy. I don't like being like, if everyone, because that's the thing about society is they'll just flip. Like one minute, everyone's the wokest person, you know, they're embracing their transgender neighbors and all that kind of stuff. And next minute, they're like going through the town with pitchforks and flaming torches and setting fire to, you know, anyone doesn't like them. So people are very, you know, they flip very easily. So you never want to be with the majority ever, ever. And you always want to be, you know, by yourself, sad, you know, locked up in a mental institute. So, so back to the programming. So anyways, oh yeah, that pod. So the other podcast, is called, Dogma of Certainty. And I'll stick a link somewhere when I do the first one, but I'm going to have to actually properly write it out because it's not stuff you can ramble on easily about without kind of saying something that's going to be misconstrued or whatever. But even if no one listens to it, it makes me feel like, you know, when the, you know, in the, you know, in a, in 50 years time, when people are, you know, pretending they weren't involved in this kind of stuff that could turn out really, really nasty, at least I'll be able to say it. But I had a podcast, you know. So, anyway, so the subject of this podcast is actually to do with, I'm going to say, well, technically it's to do with relationships, which sounds a bit like it's going to be like an episode of Grey's Anatomy or something, but it's not really. I think was it like the last podcast? What I wanted to do is actually, this was a question that was on my blog, and I was just going to read the question, and I was just going to like read through my answer because it's to do with something that happened recently. Not relationships involving me, but that someone said to me when I was doing a slideshow somewhere. So, and I think it's kind of in. I think having reread it recently, I think it's I must have written it in a spark of kind of, you ever seen True Detective, you know, that first series of True Detective? It's a bit like Rusty out of True Detective's kind of thing he would write. It's a bit, it's kind of anyway, it's what it is. So I'll read you the question. So it was like, "Hi Andy, I'm sure you were extremely busy. You're replying to Russian questions about Russian aiders and which Fifi is best. You don't even need to respond." I always respond when people say that. Like, ha, showed you. "But are climbers more susceptible to relationship issues, more so than normal people?" So this is actually a really good question, because climbers are they're a bloody disaster, really. But then I think climbers, surfers, mountain bikers, skiers, human beings, you know, Homo sapiens, they're all a disaster when it comes to relationships. So so I'm going to read you, I'll read you my response, and I'll tell you why I was reading this. So it's, "Hi, I hate reading, so I'm actually reading this because I want to learn how to read things when I'm reading. So I think I'm the last man on the planet to be giving relationship advice. I'm better at stoves and bird beaks, but here goes. My dad, a wise man, when asked a question like yours, would probably say, 'That sounds hard. Good luck with that.' This kind of answer is annoying at first, as it sucks the oxygen out of the question. He's not offering you any solution. It sounds like he's saying he doesn't want to talk about your problems. But often when times are tough, especially when it comes to relationships, all you want to do is talk and talk and talk. We don't want solutions. The pain of talking is all we want. It gives an emotional return that's valuable. It somehow allows us to connect with someone we love, someone we loved, someone we hate but love, someone we hate and hate but deep down we love. Maybe even someone we love but actually hate, but we don't know what love is anymore. That emotional response in talking and always thinking is like poking a rotten tooth with your tongue. It does no good. Only reminds you of the constant pain you already feel. But maybe by increasing the pain, you hope for some respite. Half the pain, better than double the pain. Yes, it's not good talking about these things if all you want to be is with your intimate pain. It only makes things worse. But when that's all you've got, that's good enough. Like a rotten tooth that either kills you through septicemia or is just pushed out by your immune system, things do eventually sort themselves out, but not if you have a mouthful of rotting teeth. That will either kill you or leave you sad and old and toothless. And so I'll give you a response like my dad's, but I will not give you a response like my dad's, but somewhere in between. So let's start at the top. Are climbers people you'd want to have a relationship with? Personally, having been married to a non-climber and a climber, as well as being in relationships with very driven human beings, I'd say that you need to be with someone who makes you feel normal, who normalizes who you are, which if you're a climber or a road cyclist, a runner, a Dungeon Dragons player, is someone who sees your abnormal behavior as normal, or if not less normal, then within boundaries of acceptance. For example, if you were addicted to meth, but your partner was a priest, how would that relationship go? He'd want to be doing good things, moral things, stuff that would look after his soul, praying, helping his flock, while you'd only want to be hustling for cash and smoking meth. But if he started smoking too, very soon life would be normal. Your abhorrent behaviour, just what you do, and for a while life would be perfect, a match made in hell. But then one day you can't hustle anymore. The money in the meth starts to run out and you're competing for hits. And all of a sudden, it's not about love or companionship, but all about you, what you want." I like this analogy when talking about two very motivated athletes. Having a baby or two people with a child who need to train all the time. Is being with a junkie a pathway to everlasting love? if neither person will ever put the other before their fix. So, on that front, dating a climber allows the abnormal appear normal, but still being abnormal, you have a few issues to deal with. Number one, if one person is performing better than the other, this will introduce stress into the relationship, stress and envy. Number two, if one person wants to climb with other people because they have more fun, climb harder, have less stress and arguments, then this introduces feelings of abandonment and neglect. It's like swinging or having an open marriage. Number three, if one side has a better work-life balance, say they're a teacher and finish at 3:30 and have 10 weeks summer vacation, while the only has 2 weeks, this will also introduce jealousy. Number four, if one person's life is not on track or their climbing is not going well, they may well find fault in the other and that their life is shit because they can't climb enough. They're under the illusion that climbing hard makes them happy, when really it's happy people who climb harder. And it's the other person who's made their climbing worse. Number five, what if climbing is the thing you share, the bond, but one day one of you feels the desire to climb fade? What bond do you have left? Another factor here is that strong, long-lasting relationships are made between two adults, not between children, and that climbers are often not really adults. They suffer from the widespread problem of infantilism. They avoid all responsibility, make the other be the adult, sometimes financially use love as leverage to allow them to keep playing out. Such people, although cool to be around, fun, energizing, like kids, but tend to be flakes, fuck-ups, unreliable beyond the climbing life. Yes, it's cool being a dirtbag at 19, but less so at 49. We tend to be attracted to such people, Peter Pans and Tiger Lilies, as we need to escape the nasty adult world, crushed by responsibility. Such relationships are great in the short term, but not in the long, unless you're junkies, until the drugs run out. As we all have to grow up sooner or later, Fred Becky being the exception. It's also worth not using the label climber here, as you could insert any obsessive. There is a spectrum. There is always a spectrum. From gaming to triathlon, road biking to CrossFit, and that old chestnut called working for a living, which can easily have nothing to do with making money, money only a positive byproduct. So yes, they're not a climber, but they spend 100 hours a week tending to their bonsai collection. Very often, the thing a person does is just a manifestation of who they are, not what they are, and that being driven is perhaps a result of a flaw that manifests itself as a positive. The driven are evolutionary drivers. So really, the question isn't, do I want to have a long-term relationship with a climber, but do I want to have a relationship with someone who's driven? The answer that you need to ask yourself, if you're also driven, as driven people are generally attracted to others like themselves, both because they want to feel normal, but also because maybe they can be an ally and an aid to what they're driven to do. And in brackets, if I go with Alex Honnold, my grade will go up and I can stop using cutlery. If you're not driven or less driven, then you're going to either have a miserable life if you're with such a person, always put into the shadow, or you'll be down with it. If you're the kind of person who doesn't like the sun who enjoys martyrdom, a positive in someone's character that manifests itself as a negative for them, but a positive for assholes. So yes, this isn't sounding too positive either way. So the alternative is to find a normal person. First off, I should say there is no such thing as normal, but there is, just as there is abnormal. Again, it's a spectrum, but most people seek safe lives, free from mental, physical, or emotional trauma, a cozy nest, and conformity, transforming from radical youths into their parents. Normal people probably make up 80% of the people on the planet, give or take a billion. This normal life, unradical, a little regretful, and always a little unfilled, is what someone who wants to be happy should aim to have. But the rub is, if you have drive in your DNA, although you think you want happiness when offered, the other 20% generally reject it. Strangely, the 80% look to the 20% to live the lives they'd like to live if they could. TV, books, stories, often a window into the lives of that 20%. Are we getting anywhere here? Not really, but maybe we're moving some pieces around. On a more general theory of positive intimate human relationships, also called love, is the core principle of being valued, which is the type of crap they tell you at marriage counselling. It's really about both people feeling lucky to have the other. There needs to be a balance of power that sloshes around but doesn't spill or is wasted. As soon as that power begins to slip, the man gets fat and lazy, hates his job, hates his life, feels his wife can't love him because how could she? In brackets, he turns into a pathetic loser. The power shift stops loving him. I love you, but I'm not in love with you. Classic. And things break apart, maybe in a second, maybe over half a century. So love is a balance of power, and it's letting neither party exploit that power, love, in order to get what they want, i.e. love requires constant care and supervision and balancing to be sustained, power continually evolving from physical and sexual to emotional and intellectual, eventually to a form of power so deep and meaningful it has no name. When a driven person is trying to have a long-term relationship with a less driven person, they'll have quality and power to begin with, each side adjusting to fit the other. Give it a few weeks or months and the other side will want to sit and watch Mad Men with a takeaway while the other wants to get up at 3 a.m. to train for the Iron Man. So is there a way to avoid this? An iron rule of life for me is to tell people what you want, be that business or love, to not go around the houses and get lost, to tell lies or hide the truth, but simply say, I want X, so that the other person can say yes or no or come to some compromise. I want $1 billion. I can give you 10. I'll take it. But first, you need to know what you want. If you want security, kids, a house with a picket fence, then maybe that's easy to find if you find the right man. So this woman, the person who asked the question was a woman, or it might not be a woman. If you want security, kids, a house with a picket fence, then maybe it's easy to find if you find the right man, as he makes up 40% of the planet. If you want to travel the world climbing and forego kids and security, then it's harder, as you're limited to just 10%, and most will have been taken. But then in brackets, but people are in no way fixed, either by what they want or who. But it's still possible, and they are also looking for you. But if you want it all, to have security, kids, climbing, freedom, well, this is perhaps just an Instagram fantasy. As the closer you get to this ideal life, the more you'll have to compromise, and the chances of being happy, not being miserable is maybe a better measure, will diminish. The lives of people you imagine who have it all tend to lack even the things you take for granted. I'm 48 years old, and when I look back, it's like a jumbo jet has landed on a busy highway. The wreckage stretches out behind me, the hurt, the pain, the damage caused, things I find hard to even think about still, even though they happened decades ago. It's easy to blame such wreckage on being driven, being selfish, having bad code and faults, stuff in your DNA, a man-child who shirked all responsibility, a brat. It's a nice image, that jumbo jet, calling myself out like that, a form of repentance, that yes, I have sinned, but now I ask for forgiveness as I'm fixed. But ultimately, you only become an adult, someone who does not smash and break the good things you're given until you take responsibility for who and what you are. Do that, understand yourself and what you want and what you're willing to give and give up, and you can find long-lasting love. But more importantly, be someone who can be loved, climber or not. So the reason I read that was when I was at this I did a slideshow recently, and some guy came up, and he was obviously a really, really good climber, and he started asking me about getting divorced. And so I've been a bit, I've only been divorced once, really. I aspire to be divorced many times, but no, I've only been divorced once. But he basically wanted to know what it was like to be a climber who, you know, did a lot of climbing and traveled around and did all this kind of stuff and was divorced and had kids and everything else. And often when people talk about getting divorced, the first thing I say is like, have you got any kids? And if they say no, I'm like, well, it's not really, you're not really getting divorced at all. You know, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, someone might get upset, but whatever. I can't remember what I actually said to him, but I think the big thing is that often people mistake things in their lives. They think the problem is like, I think the problem's like easily fixable. Getting divorced is not an easy thing to do, but it's very easy to put the blame on why you're not happy on somebody else or something else. But I think I told him I have this idea. So when I was a kid, a big film at the time was The Amityville Horror, which was about a poltergeist that was in this, this house, and it was like, you know, it was a gateway to hell or something. And I remember my mum had a copy of The Amityville Horror. So this was like 1970 something anyway. In this story, I remember reading like some little, you know, like I wasn't very good at reading, so it probably took me like all day to like read like one page. But I think I just read the last page of the book to see what happened. But in this, my mum maybe told me. But anyway, but in this thing, like they ran away from this house to get away from this poltergeist, but the poltergeist like followed them to the next house. And the story goes that you can't escape from a poltergeist unless you cross water, then the poltergeist can't follow you. So I've always thought that was like quite a good analogy for like people who think that they can fix a relationship by some like drastic measure, you know. So the classic one is like, I'm not happy with my life, and I think if I get divorced and leave this mother of my children, I can just go and go climbing in the Himalayas or whatever, or, you know, I'm just going to go to America and go climbing in America. But it's really not that easy, and it's not that possible, because basically you're haunted by something and you can't get away from it. Like you may think you've escaped from it by getting divorced or, you know, so you can climb more, but you'll very quickly be back in exactly the same position, because it's generally not to, unless your wife or your husband's like beating you up or something. The problem with the environment or your life is something to do with you, rather than something to do with someone else. So I think that was my advice to him, was like to try and find some alternative, you know, like sometimes things can be, you can do a really radical, you know, it's almost like, you know, if someone said, I'm not very happy, I'm just going to kill my entire family and go and find another one. You know, it's like, that's kind of fairly drastic. So you might be like, maybe I've made like a really bad choice in my life, but it wasn't to do with the person I married. It was actually to do with my whole career. And what I'm doing, because you have this thing where you feel like you're, you know, I think once you get to like your 30s, 40s, 50s, you have this feeling where you feel like you've completely fucked everything up and you've made some really bad choices, and you can feel like you're on this track and you're never going to get off it. But really, you shouldn't codify it. You can get off it as soon as you want. And you know, the classic thing is people who get made redundant and they feel like it's the end of the world. Like one minute they're saying they hate this job, you know, and they want to, you know, they hate it and they want to kill themselves and blah, blah, blah. And then they get made redundant. It's the worst thing that's ever happened to them, and they have no job. And I would say nearly in every case, it's like a massive blessing, you know, that people, they're forced to change their lives. And you end up with like they can almost like start again. This idea of like, you know, the idea again of back to the beginning of this podcast about self-destruction is you have an opportunity to pick through the pieces of your life and work out what you want to keep and what you want to discard. So always remember this poltergeist is with you. Like, can you actually come to some kind of arrangement with the poltergeist? Can you, like, you know, sacrifice one of the kids or something? Or can you, do something radical? Like, let's go and live in a different country, or I'm going to give my job up. You know, we can, you know, we feel like we're on this. Another analogy is that you're on this train in your life, and this train is like hurtling along, and it's not able to stop, and there's no way you can put the brakes on. You kind of know where it's going, but you have no interest of going there, but you have no control over it. So I call it like locked in life syndrome. You know, you're just there like a witness to this like shit life, and your terrible relationship with your wife and your kids or your husband or your workmates, and your life is this terrible kind of prison. The only way you're ever going to stop is for this train to be like derailed, you know, and it might just kill all of you. It might kill you. It's like the worst thing you can imagine. And I think I joked to someone the other day who was a psychiatrist, like a healthcare professional. The job of like of doctors and people and psychiatrists is just to keep laying the track. Do you know what I mean? You know, it's like you are really, really depressed and your life is shit and everything else. But if I give you these tablets, basically this is like giving you another extra 50 miles of track. And hopefully by the time these tablets run out, or, you know, you'll have slowed down or something. But don't try, you know, don't do anything too radical, because if you try and stop this train, the only way you can stop it is you can blow up this bridge, you know, in 5 miles time. But it's above a massive canyon, and you will stop, but you know you'll never go again. So I don't know why this like stuck in my head. It's been in my head a long time, this guy saying this, and we don't really have very good guidance of what to do, really, do we? Don't really have a, you know, you don't want to. I think there's that side, one side of you that's, you know, there's a really, really radical idea of what to do, and then there's like a more human thing with what to do. But I think you really have to just try and find a way of dealing with it in a positive way, if not just kicking it down the road. And try as hard as you can. You know, like it's a kind of basic life or death situation. You could be drowning, you could be dying in a storm on K2 or whatever. But you really got to try as hard as you can, you know, before you hit the final option, which is either getting a divorce or dying on a mountain. So hopefully that didn't sound too negative. Hopefully, if you're like 16, you listen to this, you'd be like, oh, that was shit. I don't get the point of that, you know. But if you're 40, you probably know exactly what I'm talking about. So fuck the youth. Anyway, So yeah, maybe because this was actually a bit deeper meaningful or not, I'll probably do another podcast on Tuesday I've still not done lanyards, have I? Yeah, lanyards. I'm definitely going to do that. I promise I'll do lanyards on Tuesday. So anyone who is, disappointed about all this love stuff. But anyway, but relationships, the most important thing in your life, relationships. It doesn't have to be loving somebody, It's all the same thing, basically. Whether you're having sex with someone or not, doesn't really matter. It's all the same thing. So even with yourself, but you can have sex with yourself. So thanks for listening to this podcast. And it's always helpful to tell people, like share it somewhere. I know people share so much. It's kind of pointless these days to share anything, isn't it? You know, just don't bother sharing it. In fact, stop listening altogether. And that's all. So thank you for listening, and I shall see you soon.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.